Hello and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan. I'm the author of the non-fiction books How to Be a Grown-Up and The Sisterhood. Just in case you're new to the podcast, my first novel, Insatiable, a love story for greedy girls, is available for listeners to pre-order from Waterstones in an exclusive signed edition. Insatiable is the story of Violet, a bored, lost and lonely 20-something who is seeking adventure and thinks she's found it when she becomes professionally and romantically involved with the glamorous Lottie and Simon. It's a love story with a twist. It's got sad bits, funny bits and, be warned, seriously filthy bits. Huge, huge thanks to all of you who have already pre-ordered. I'm trying to come up with a special treat for those listeners, especially because you've had to listen to me banging on about it every time I've recorded this podcast. Now to this week's guest. Jessie Burton's smash hit debut, The Miniaturist, made her a household name, and she has continued to dazzle her readers with thoughtful, challenging and complex stories. Her latest book, The Confession, has just come out in paperback, and it's my favourite. I think it's her best book yet. Jessie takes us from the 70s, literary Bloomsbury and glamorous Hollywood, to the present day, by way of an ordinary superstar novelist, her lover and one woman's search for her mother. So it was fitting for Jessie and me to talk about motherhood, creativity and time. We also discussed boozing in books, the bittersweet nature of rereading, and how to share books with the people you love the most. We talk about Sheila Hattie's Motherhood, which I read pretty much immediately after we stopped recording. So thanks for the recommendation, Jessie. Enjoy. Have you been reading in lockdown? Have you wanted to read?
Yeah, I know that some people have said that, you know, it's been impossible to read. But actually, that's like one of the only things I have been able to do. So I have read, not loads and loads and loads because I've been working, but I've been able to read, which I'm quite grateful for. I haven't been able to do much else. So, yeah.
And what have been the highlights? Have you come to anything that you might not have picked up otherwise, or has anything taken you by surprise?
Yeah. I mean, I let me have a look, because I did write a list, because I'm terrible for this. Like, I people ask me, you know, what have you been reading, and I literally sound like the most illiterate author. It's been quite varied. So I've read The Last Princess by Anne Glenconner.
Oh,
kind of escapist, jaw-dropping, I cannot believe people live like this experience.
Is that her Lady in Waiting book?
That's the one.
I just read that at my parents' house, and I have so many things that I want to talk about and ask you. The weird sort of her insane, the husband.
The marriage.
The man being so awful, he was banned from, is it British Airways who banned him?
I think it is British Airways. I mean, I felt it was both sort of, you know, it's so fun in a way that kind of, it's not even like the way the other half live. It's like the way this like tiny 25th live. I mean, it's just bonkers. And I like that, the kind of outrageousness of it. But also, I mean, it's a tragic story. You know, she lost two sons.
Yes. I believe.
But also, I think this experience of essentially sort of being so inexperienced and marrying this man, Colin Tennant, who was so volatile and so damaged. And you just think, I just thought it was an indictment of the British class system, of the boarding school system. I was just like, these are weird people.
That part as well, where she goes to her mum to say, my husband is a violent, dangerous lunatic. And she more or less says, well, you chose your choice. You married him, suck it up.
Yeah.
Did you read the Craig Brown book about Princess Margaret?
I did. Yeah, I did. So I've had a bit, and I think it all came from watching The Crown. I love it. And I was like, okay, I need to find a bit more out about Princess Margaret. And I've had a lot of friends say to me, you will love Mom Darling or Ma'am Darling. And I did. And then, of course, Lady Glenconner, she was the Nancy, what's her surname, who played Lady Glenconner in The Crown. She came to interview Lady Glenconner to sort of find out about her life. And then, of course, as she sat there and began to give her some insight, she realized it was actually a very unique life that sort of ran parallel to the development of the 20th century and moved from this time where she said, like, it would take 15 minutes to get a boiled egg from where the children were in the nursery from the kitchen, so you could sort of boil the egg en route and all that kind of weird thing, you know, that kind of space and luxury. And a good escapist read, a good sort of, that was quite early on in lockdown, that was a sort of sort of ease myself in gently. And then I read Kindred by Octavia Butler, who I'd never read her stuff. And I was at a historical fiction conference in Pasadena a few years ago, and they have her archive and all her kind of written manifestations about how she was going to be a writer. And, you know, she was a young black girl in Pasadena and intelligent and hungry for knowledge and hungry to do all these things. And she did do them. And it's a fantastic biography, although she died too young. And then I'd never read anything. And then my friend said, you should try it. It's more sort of, she did a lot of time travel and sci-fi. And it's a story about a woman in the 70s, a black woman, who is connected to this white man in the 17th century, I think it is, maybe early 18th, who is a slave owner, plantation owner, and he is her ancestor because of his raping and, pillage of his property, his slaves. And it's her job to save him. She travels back in time to save him in order to actually live herself in the 20th century. And it's this, I suppose, philosophical inquiry into the interconnectedness, hence it being called Kindred, of the whites in America and the blacks in America. You know, I've read a couple of other novels set on plantations, The Book of Night Women by Marlon James, which is one of my favorite books, and The Long Song, and a couple of others. But this one is so interesting because it brings the morality and the physicality and the brutality of the slave system, the sort of Holocaust that was slavery, into the 20th century. And she travels back in time, comes back into her flat in California, and has to take paracetamol for the whip marks on her back. And all of that sort of stuff, it's extremely clever. And, you know, there's a fear that she's going to get trapped in the past as well, both literally and metaphorically speaking. So that was a good one.
I mean, I'm ashamed to say I've never read any Octavia Butler. I think partly because I fear the science fiction element. It sounds like it's much more of a human story than that. And I'm really curious about how she, Octavia Butler as a writer and also that character, sort of dealt with a really brilliant and complex idea of saving a person who seems unsavable, whose role has been
he is awful in the book. You're like, oh good god, yeah, that's the question she asks. Like, she has the opportunity to let him die, but if she lets him die, then she won't be born. I think perhaps maybe one of her overarching messages in the book is that, not that he is a victim of the system, he is a huge beneficiary of the system, but that when you have this, which was essentially, well, a proto-capitalist or a capitalist system where the dollar is king and the white man is at the top of the pile, behavior morphs. And I think the best books that deal with the history and legacy of slavery shows the moral compromises that both whites, not so much the black characters, but also some of them as well, enter into in order to survive, doing things that they didn't necessarily think they'd end up doing, you know, wouldn't want to do maybe in a different situation.
Have you read Corregidora by Gail Jones? I read it just before lockdown, and it's great. It's arresting. It really, it's one of those books that just like propels you.
You'll have to get me the name again, because I need to get my pen and paper.
I'll send
so everything.
I know that... The Gail Jones is for the Y, it's G-A-Y-L, Jones.
There's two others that I've read that have kind of stuck with me. Motherhood by Sheila Hetty. Have you read it?
No, and I think that the Margate Bookshop currently have a copy for me, and I have been attempting to read that book for about 5 years.
Me too, exactly the same. Like, it's kind of like the Venn diagram of motherhood, creativity, because the narrator is a woman. The narrator is a writer as well as a woman. She can be both. it's a miracle. And for some reason, like, I've been putting it off, and I knew it was kind of like perfect for me. Like, I love that kind of thing. It's that quite not common, that's not the right word, but familiar idea that the narrator sounds very similar to Sheila Hetty herself. the narrator's boyfriend is the same name as her boyfriend in real life. And, you know, the inquiry into whether or not to become a mother is obviously one close to her heart.
So we're in the realms of autofiction.
Yes, I believe so. It's one of the most generous books I've ever read about this topic to all women, women who are mothers, women who don't want to be mothers, women who want to be mothers but who aren't. And she has this idea of the not mother and how we're all the not mother, because some are not mothers and some are not mothers. And it took me a while to get my head around it. But she says, you know, we sort of hang on these states and use them as sort of sticks to beat each other with. She has this very loving, very honest relationship with her partner who already has a child, a daughter. And he has said to her, it's got to be your choice. I'd be happy not to have any more children. So she goes on this kind of philosophical journey about whether or not she should. But what for me was so powerful about it was the loving way with which she wrote about her creativity, her need to write, her books, her work, the nurture of that, her purpose on this planet, which was just so beautifully, tenderly written, and not in a kind of saccharine way, but just in a way that I felt she really held its worth. And the other thing that's so brilliant about it is her role as a daughter, because she even asks, should I be a daughter rather than a mother? Is that my job on this planet? And it's partly informed by the fact that on her mother's side, they are all Holocaust survivors. So there's that perhaps need to regenerate or to do very, very well to succeed that her mother instilled in her and has kind of made their relationship at times very fractious, but also has meant that they have a very deep understanding of each other. So I found it deeply moving, and I'm not a page bender, like on the corners of pages, but that is my one book. I have a little chest of drawers next to my bed, which is all the special books, and motherhood has gone on that one, because I was like, Sheila, you really hit that one out of the park there.
I might have to stop this interview, run down to the bookshop and hammer on the window and be like, I need it now! Honestly, every book you've talked about so far, I am sold. Were you ever a bookseller? I know that you have been an actor and...
Yeah. No, I've never flogged a book, but my partner did. He was a bookseller.
Ah! Which books has he sold to you on recommendation? Is he a good recommender of books?
He's a great recommender. So one of his sort of flirting offerings was that he thought that I would really like Fates and Furies by Lauren Groff. And when someone recommends you a book that you don't know so well, and like imagine like you're just like, dude, what, why have you suggested this terrible novel that I hate? But actually I was like, oh, this is a really good book, super good. And I was like, oh, and I really like, he has a lot of, he's a very comprehensive reader. He will read across the board, like sci-fi, fantasy, but also he has very literary taste as well, and non-fiction. He's very curious, and he's kind of made me kind of open my horizons a bit, hence probably picking up Kindred by Octavia Butler. So yeah, he's wooed me with Fates and Furies.
Are you living together? And if so, do you have to share book space? Do you have any separate bookshelves, or is it?
Yeah, we've been together 4 years under the same roof. But you know, he has his own books in piles by his bed. They have not intermingled. There's a shelf behind a chair where it's like we're starting to like breed.
I was wondering if it's maybe like, you know, French women saying always lock the bathroom door and maintain the mystery. I wanted to go back to motherhood and what you're saying about creativity and the very affirming way it sounds like Sheila Hattie and the character of Sheila talk about that and live that. And I think it's really interesting how you talk about art and being the creator in your own novels, and that being something that can sort of bring joy and pain and light and complication. Did you feel any differently about writing having read Motherhood?
I felt more proud of what I do, actually. I think, you know, one sense of self-worth or the good work one's doing fluctuates. But when there are certain passages in that book which she just clarifies how important it is and how it's not just for her a hobby and it's her way of making sense of the world and it's her offering. And I think, you know, maybe 2 years ago, I was quite resistant to the kind of language that you know, people use, oh, your book baby, or, you know, talking about pushing out a book. Or, but I have to say that the longer I sat with that and the more I thought about my work and the way I think about my books and the way I talk about them unconsciously, I do talk about them in a quite nurturing sense. And a child that you might have physically is as much an imagined creation. You have an idea of a child that you're going to have in your mind, and then they're born and they're not that. And I think that's actually a similar parallel to writing a book. You have a perfect book in your mind, and then of course you're faced with reality and an unknowability as well. And the idea that we as writers, we do gestate our ideas and we have to put a lot of time and effort into them. And then once they're written and they're born and they're put out into the world and they have to live in the world with other people and be cared for by other people, we can't look after them. And of course, I accept that that metaphor is, you know, it's not the same as like having to feed, clothe and educate a child. Obviously, I'm, you know, but the internal care and thought and value, I think I have realized, you know, the way I talk about my books is similar to how I hear women talking about their babies.
Well, I don't know if this sort of strikes any kind of chord, but we interviewed Tracy Chevalier, and she's really great. And obviously she is, you know, as you are, has been sort of immensely and consistently successful over a long period of time. But perhaps, I don't know if you feel this way about your work or not, but having one like stratospheric mega 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 book that's just this sort of eclipsing defining thing, and obviously for her it was The Girl with the Pearl Earring. Oh. And she was really interesting and I thought really generous about not just that book but about the people who love it. And I think people love it like they love One Direction or like they love the Mona Lisa, you know. She seemed really genuinely happy to just relinquish that. It's like lots of people want to own that book and I'm happy to let them have it.
Yeah, no, and I think that definitely resonates, that sense of collective ownership. And particularly with the miniatures, for me, I feel I'm always struck when people, you know, they do take it into their hearts. And it's a book that I think if you do like it or you do love it, it's passionately, it's as a fan, you know. And that's the kind of magic of the contract I think you have with a reader. You don't know them, you never meet them. And for me, well, you do sometimes obviously, but I mean generally, they kind of complete the book for you on their own, and they take it into their psyche, their imagination, their heart, and the characters populate their mind. I mean, it's such a bonkers concept when you think of it, that, you know, on paper you then kind of can colonize someone's mind.
Are there any books that you feel as though your reading has been almost unique, or books that have moved you in such a way that you feel of that kind of intimacy with them?
I think those kind of books for me, probably more when I was younger. I think if you get those books in maybe before the age of about 12, do recalibrate your mind, when your mind is that plastic and sponge-like. So I think there are a few, and I think, you know, they're probably quite common. You know, Jane Eyre, Rebecca by Du Maurier, Matilda by Roald Dahl, The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley, Pride and Prejudice. These were books that, you know, big adult titles that I took off the shelves when I was about 11, 12. And there's a big difference, I think, between being 12 and even being 15. There are books, obviously, and I'm 37, like there are obviously books since then that have struck me, like Cat's Eye by Atwood, which I read when I was 16. It was a set text for A-level. Certain Poets, Tom Gunn.
Oh my God, I love, you know, Tom Gunn.
Yeah, like he wrote one of my favourite poems. By that age, 16, 17, you're really honing your critical abilities. And you start to think, oh my God, like that's a really phenomenal way of expressing that idea. But those books that you read when you're younger, they kind of sort of enter your bloodstream in a different way. And you do feel an immediate resurrection of the Red Room in Jane Eyre that you pictured when you were 11. So you're now 37 and you're reading it, and Jane is still the same age, and Charlotte Bronte's been dead for 200 years or whatever. So it's It's a phenomenon, really.
A feeling as much as a reading.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't want to say lowbrow, but I recently reread Ballet Shoes. Found a really beautiful edition of Ballet Shoes at Crofton Bookshop, which I strongly recommend if you're in Southeast London and looking for a bargain. But, you know, I read that book a lot, and I've only recently realised that Nell Streatfeild, it's like pony books are really for girls who don't have horses and ponies. If you're properly horsey, you are out with your horses. There's lots of wishful thinking and, you know, Jill's Gymkhana and things. And it's the same. There are lots of, you know, that sort of this idea of kind of the stage school kid. I think that Nell Streatfeild speaks to lots of children who never quite got that far. When I was a kid, it seemed so, you know, triumphant.
Yeah, yeah. And also very plausible. Like, that's the thing, I think, especially when you're a child, you know, you read a story like that, which has so many fantastical fairy tale elements. The agent turning up is like the fairy godmother.
Age 35, though, I got to the end and I cried and cried and cried. And I just saw these sisters and this family being torn apart and these little girls making these terrifying, very adult compromises.
But it's also, you know, an emotional read because they're all still there in that perpetual motion. Like, and you're older and you're, you know, I always find that it's like you find yourself again when you read those old stories that are so familiar to you. And in a way, like they don't die. And it sounds silly to say, but they're just always on a sort of loop. Certain books for people just remain like that kind of comfort, but also very emotional, like melancholic, because it's, you know, sometimes the best books are the ones that there is escapism, but you're almost escaping to somewhere unreachable. So it's plunging into a foreign world that you can never get to, but actually by the act of reading you are there. It's paradox, and memory is like that, and getting older is like that when you think of your past life.
And yeah, perhaps, you know, that's it, that every time, you know, reading it as a child, I was like, and you know, and the agent will come for me and it's all going to be, and I sort of, and realizing how far away I am, obviously I am no farther away from that happening because it was never remotely possible, but so far from the idea, I guess that it's the walls between the book and reality get thicker maybe on every reread.
That's very true. And sometimes you can be a bit scared to reread an old favourite because even though I've just said, yes, you know, you revisit it and it's all still there for you, there can be times when you go, it's like watching another movie that you've loved and then you go back to it and you're like, why did I think this was good? This is terrible. And it's such a shame because you destroyed your 8-year-old fantasy of it. But equally, yes, you can, with every reread, you can feel more and more distant. But my book like that was probably Matilda by Dahl. And I remember staring at pencils, trying to make them levitate. And I kind of still think that I could probably levitate a pencil. Like, that's the weird thing. Like, obviously, rationally, I know I can't. But then there's that little 6-year-old girl, Jessie, who read that in 1988, is still there in me.
It lit within me a real lust for revenge, did Matilda.
Exactly. I even said to my, you know, I wanted to try cornflakes because Matilda was eating them. And it's like you just said, that synthesis between reality and fiction and is very porous when you're little. And, you know, I've written one children's book, The Restless Girls, and that's been so gratifying as an author to do events with children because it speaks to my imaginative willingness when they just take it, they accept it, they go with it, they make it their own. It's so gorgeous to witness. Whereas obviously when you're an adult, rationality and cynicism and fatigue.
Oh, yes, the fatigue. God.
All the best things, you know, kick in and you don't have that same immediate immersion in a world where everything is, you know, the stakes are genuinely high or, you know, pigs really can talk and all of that things that you believe when you're little.
And I imagine at those events, I'm guessing that children are a lot less inhibited and much more direct. What is there any sort of active element that you do beyond reading?
Oh yeah, like so the Restless Girls, part of the plot of the Restless Girls was that the girls descend a staircase into a underground world of three forests of gold, silver and diamonds, and then they find the Tree Palace where there's a jazz band playing. And so I invited them to sort of make their own fantasy world and what was in it, how did we get to it, what kind of foods were available. You know, we just built as a group a whole world. And it was just so wonderful to sort of have them all shout out ideas and stuff. And nobody asked me, what's your writing process like? Thank you, guys. You're going to ask me what my favorite cheese is, whether I have a boyfriend. it was totally so much more fun.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We'll be back to Jessie soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week, The Dutch House by Ann Patchett. It's 1950-something. On the east coast of America, and Maeve and Danny are growing up in the grandest house on the block. Their father is distant, their mother has disappeared, but they're happy enough. When their father remarries, their old life starts to slip away from under them, and they lose the home they have loved and hated, a home that keeps them under its spell. I loved this book like I love A Prayer for Owen Meany. It's lived on my pile for over a year and I've been feeling obliged to read it for some time, and I was very afraid it was going to be a little bit dry and worthy and quite important. I was so wrong. It's juicy, it's urgent, it's engaging. It's about family dynamics at their most layered and brittle. I wish I could tell you precisely why I loved it so much. The best I can do is to say that I felt a little bit brokenhearted when I finished the last page and I had to live in the real world and not the Conroy's imaginary one. The Dutch House by Ann Patchett is published by Bloomsbury and out now. Now, back to Jessie.
Well, that does remind me, though, that when, as a young reader, and still, there is nothing I loved more than a really good food description. That's something that hasn't changed with Bad Issues, is given it's, you know, they're very, very concerned about money, they still seem to eat very, very well.
I've just read,
and I think it's coming out in a couple of weeks, V for Victory by Lissa Evans, which is...
Oh, I've heard that I should read Lissa Evans. Like, everyone's saying to me, read her. I need to read her.
And I was just thinking, there's such a brilliant description of food at the end, and it's a kind of real, like, wartime, you know, treats are coming, and it was very, very pleasing to consume.
Well, that actually reminded me, because the friend who recommended Lissa to me also recommended Eva Ribbertson's Adult.
She keeps coming up. They've just been reissued, I believe.
Yeah. And so I, in lockdown, I read The Secret Countess, which you reminded me of it because of the food. And again, there's this, you know, there is privation. It's after the First World War, but they still manage to eat like kings, because again, it's that fantasy, fantastical element that I think is always appealing to people. That never stops, I don't think.
It's just talking about that, and because I suppose now there's all, you know, lots of concerns about, you know, what we're eating and how much of it we're eating, what we should all weigh, and, you know, the coronavirus and stuff. I read in one big binge all the Catholic Chronicles in lockdown. I was saying, and that, you know, they're not atypical. There are lots of books set around that time about a certain class of people that have a very similar sort of pattern. Mm. All they did was eat. There was an element of wish fulfillment that wasn't, you know, it's not like mass observation, but everyone had 4,000 calories a day in wartime and they were fine.
Yeah. And also the alcohol consumption.
Yes.
Like, what was going on with that? Like, so much whiskey, wine, champagne before 10 a.m. People must have been lunatics.
Well, that was going right back to the beginning in Princess Margaret. My favourite detail was her day of coffee and papers and a lot of vodka and orange and a blow dry and a swim and another blow dry and a boozy lunch and a lie down and cocktails and then dinner.
Incredible. I mean, she just must have been buzzed all the time. Just constant topping up of a certain level. I'm not much of a drinker, so I notice it in books when, you know, I just finished Saturday Lunch with the Brownings, the short story collection of Penelope Mortimer for the third time. It's so good. Actually, that was another book that my partner wooed me with as a birthday present. So I got recommended by Lucy Scholes, the critic, that I should give her short stories a go. I've read her novels, her early novels, and loved them. And so my partner got me a paperback because it was out of print. And there was this fantastic story in it called Little Mrs. Perkins about this woman who's in the maternity ward next to the narrator. And it's all touch and go about whether the baby's going to make it. And they're all like, oh, Mrs. Perkins, we're so sorry. You know, she's like, oh, I'm so sad, you know, but hopefully we will get to go to Tenerife. So there's a holiday that she wants to go to Tenerife. And her husband's saying, well, you have to stay and do bed rest because, you know, you're in a fragile state. As soon as the nurses and the husband goes away, this woman starts cycling her legs really hard in the air. And the narrator realizes she's trying to induce an abortion. And I got to the page where, like, the narrator's going to find out what happens, and the pages were missing. No, I need to know what happened to Little Mrs. Perkins.
And it's out of print.
It's out of print, and this one copy I've got no pages in it. So anyway, he sourced a first edition. So that was just going back to his good
thoroughly approve of this man.
Yeah, he gets 10 out of 10. But anyway, in all of her stories, I mean, Mortimer was a big drinker. I think a lot of people were. Like, we're talking about 50, 60. The amount of whiskey these people knock back, like three whiskeys before he then goes out to the pub. I'm just like, I would be green. I would be rolling on the floor. Also, you can't write when you're drinking, I don't think. Like, it's just, the brain just fizzles away. But
it's taken me a really long time to figure that out. I mean, again, back to my very highbrow literary picks. I love Julie Cooper very much, and her books.
I would never have known that, David.
It's a secret. Don't tell no one.
Keep it very low. No, I love it. I love that you're so, you know, supportive and
loving. She is the best. Her books are so boozy. And I think it has taken me, honestly, until the age of 35, which I am now, to be like, it's a book. It's not normal to be able to drink that much alcohol and function. I actually function an awful lot better when I stay clear. But it's, I suppose, as sad as knowing that I'm not going to be one of the Fossil Sisters, as sad as I can't be a sort of a fabulous, you know, career drinker.
I think you're better off for it. I mean, when I wrote The Muse, which is my second novel, there's a character in it, Marjorie Quick, who drinks gin and tonics and cocktail. And I definitely... it's a sort of wish fulfillment that, you know, to have someone who can remain icy calm and, you know, debonair and full of quips whilst, you know, three sheets to the wind. I think novelists like it just as much as they like writing about food. Maybe, I don't know whether it's more women than men. I do tend to read more women writers anyway, so I don't, except for, of course, like the St. Albyn, the Melrose novels, which, I mean, in terms of debauchery, they are like off the scale. But yeah, it's easier in books, I think, to have people drink to excess and eat to excess and not ever have gas or like hungover.
That's it. No one's reaching for emoji.
No one's doing a tiny sick in the handbag. People drink loads and then get up and do. Yes, there are obviously like hangovers in novels and stuff, but like, most of the time they just carry on. I'm like, these people's livers, just terrible.
I've only read the first three Patrick Melrose books, and I thought they're all the first and second ones were just brutal and amazing, and the third one is really, really good. But that the second one, in his description of being at that lunch, is it with like friends of his father's, and they're all drinking huge Bloody Marys, and he's like, well, if I take all of this heroin now, I won't have to go back and have some later. My own experience there is nil, but I have a feeling that is very much not how heroin works. But then the third one, with that book being a little bit of an ordeal and quite, you know, very bitchy and funny and well written, but still a bit of a struggle. I'm like, because it's that party in real time. And it's like, that's the hell of being a sober person at an out of control party. that's what the book is.
Yeah, that is so true. It's so true. That's really well put. And it's, I think it's really hard to do, to write drunk. I mean, to put drunkenness in novels. It's very hard to write drunk full stop, but to actually depict it. Actually, one of my favorite books is Lucky Jim by Kingsley Amis, which is one of the first books I ever read that made me actually laugh out loud. Not that I'm a humorless person, but just, you know, that really made me lol. And he does people at parties and drunkenness and hangovers really well in that book, just the kind of horrendousness of it when, you know, you're at a social gathering you don't want to be at, or whether you were, or you feel rancid the next day. But then that's quite glamorous though. It's still sort of making it humorous and a bit good old boys, not you know, the sordid reality of it.
That you wake up and shake yourself down and just, you know, and go back out again the next day.
Yeah, go to the pub. Yeah.
I don't think I've ever read Lucky Jim. It's one of those books that I think I've read, but I've actually read a lot of Martin Amis, and that does not mean I've automatically read his dad. It doesn't work that way.
I've only read his dad, Kingsley, and I've only read that one. But there's a scene where he like makes faces behind his hand, and it sounds so basic, but it's just, I don't know. I was, you know, 21 or two when I picked it up, and I'd not read many comic novels. I think it's a very hard skill.
And
very
good character. Is something so thrilling when it happens and it does make you laugh and you think, this is allowed in a book?
I know. Have you read Priest Daddy?
Yes, I loved that book.
That is one of the funniest books I've ever read. Like, I was wheezing. She is a genius.
But it's just her mum is the star and the comic genius of the book. Yeah. It's dazzling.
Even when you, I remember reading it and reading my partner bits out loud, which can be really annoying when people do that. But I was like, no, you have to hear this. And he was laughing too, because even though he didn't know anything other than the passage, because she just has a great turn of phrase and a great way of setting up the scene. David Sedaris is good for that as well, obviously. It's, what is it with Americans? They're so good at that. The droll.
I'm reading at the moment The Letters of E.B. White. It's enormous. And I'm making very slow progress. It's not sort of his essays, or it's just his account of his work and his life and his doings. He's just started at the New Yorker. And he does have a real, almost, I suppose, a pooterish. Like, he's no misanthrope. He's a very cheerful and happy man.
Yeah.
But just always looking out for things that are a bit kind of weird or interesting, or that, you know, observing and, you know, having sort of both eyes, I think, really looking out at the world and seeing how how much nonsense surrounds us all.
Yeah, I think it must be hard to be that aware of people's foibles and flaws, because it must mean that you're aware of your own as well. And to write it, and, you know, they're always the cliche that, you know, comics are quite morose or sad people, or, you know, they can sense the dark side. They always say, don't they, like, if you've got friends in a play, like, don't come round backstage and think that they're all going to go to the pub with you if they've just all been in a comedy. But if they've all just been in a tragedy, they'll all, you know, everyone will be high spirited and wanting to party. You know, like, let's just go to the fun side of things. Yeah, whereas being comic and sensing humour and everything, I think you always have to acknowledge the underside of it, really.
I'd like to think that it's sort of comforting to just know that everyone and everything is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, I think that as I kind of like move through my career, one of my ambitions or aims is to sort of write characters who are flawed and contradictory. I think when you're younger, you know, as a child, the sort of stories you write archetypes, or you actually don't. And, you know, you have characters who just do all kinds of things that contradict each other and there's no sense. And then you go through a phase of like trying to make everything make sense. And then I think the great skill is to create characters who do not bad things, but things that maybe leave a bad taste in your mouth as the reader. But then you kind of are put in a really difficult position morally, because you still like them, or you're rooting for them, or someone lets you down in a book, but then they redeem themselves and then they do something bad again. You know, that is the reality of life, right? Like, we are so flawed and incomplete and a constant works in progress until the day we die. Trying to capture that on the page is something I really aim to do. constantly.
I was thinking a lot about Elise in The Confession. That book is full of those people, but, you know, to have someone that you do feel, or I felt very, very tenderly towards and frustrated by and disappointed in, but also I was sort of, you know, reaching for her. Mm. Who are the characters that you feel morally challenged or compromised by?
Oh, God. I mean, I'm just trying to think, like, a recent book where I think that's been achieved really well is Summer Water by Sarah Moss. She's a very gifted novelist. I loved Ghost Wall. The premise of Summer Water is it's all over one day at a Scottish Highland holiday camp. And there are a lot of English there. And there's a kind of tension between the Scots and the English and some more recently arrived Eastern Europeans as well. But the first chapter is a middle-aged woman, mother of two, I believe, and her slightly layabout husband is still asleep in the cabin and she's on a long run. And she's not a likable person always, but certain things she says in her inner monologue alluding to her husband, you do feel immediately sympathetic, and then she'll remove that again. And that's like within a few pages. So I found that really interesting. And I think, again, it's that confidence of an older writer to do that, to know that she's in control.
Yeah.
I can't on my head think of others, but I mean, obviously, like, oh, and not, oh, I can. Now I said that. Somebody like Olive Kitteridge.
Yes, 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 yes. That's a perfect example, I think.
Just like majestic cruelty of her thoughts, her pettinesses, and then her generosity to people. It's just like, how the hell does Elizabeth Strout do that?
I can't remember if it's in Olive Kitteridge or Olive again. It's either her new daughter-in-law or her daughter-in-law-to-be.
Oh, God,
and
yeah.
Olive's just so pissed off with her and doesn't really know what. It's a general feeling of annoyance. And she just hides a shoe in her handbag. And I thought the pettiness and daftness of that was so funny and so sort of, really, you know, because I think we've all felt like that, haven't we?
Where I'm we're sure just we have.
So maddened by someone. Like, what will drive you demented?
And also, she feels like that about her son. Like the things she thinks about her son, it's so rare to see a woman who will think such uncharitable thoughts and put them, you know, and express them for our benefit. Like it's very powerful when a novelist is gifted as Strout does it. Yeah, it's like, oh God. And understands, you know, the fact that there's a sort of 13-year-old girl still stuck in her body somewhere who wants to hide a shoe in a handbag because she's jealous. She's jealous. Like, you know, she's being ousted and she's not, she doesn't feel in control of things and she thinks other people are just sort of below her or like, you know, letting her down.
It's funny, isn't it? Because when we talk about things being gritty, I think we imagine a sort of, I don't know, like Brookside at its most brooding or, you know, really sort of like bleak and horrible. But I think grittiness should be just that your life being the sort of like low level irritants all the time. Just a sort of, nothing is awful, but there's a sort of constant rising of friction that you can't quite shake off.
Yeah, but that's so hard to write. And I think doing kind of domestic ennui or petty cruelties or, you know, shallow behaviours, making them meaningful or making them universal is a very difficult thing to do. And I think that's probably why so many books, and, you know, don't get me wrong, I love operatic, melodramatic, theatrical books and characters who are larger than life and scenarios that are unlikely and yet feel likely because they're between the boards of a book. But the novelists who I admire the most probably are the most economic novelists, like Strout or Penelope Mortimer, you know, these people who can just like distill that kind of grittiness, which is so familiar. And it's not about, you know, drama in the courtroom or whatever.
I really loved Expectation by Anna Hope for that. And
I haven't read it.
It's about the tensions in the sort of relationship between three different women and that they are all quite ordinary. You know these women and it's to take an archetype and something that's often, you know, dismissed and made two-dimensional, and really, really realise that and make that worthy of our attention as readers, I think it's masterful.
Well, I definitely need to pick that one up then, because I love that kind of elevation of the, you know, particularly feminine experience, I suppose, that, you know, does, as you say, get reduced. And I think it's happening more and more that the lived experience of women is being treated very seriously as art, which I think the male experience has always been the default universal experience. You know, we're very good ventriloquists, I think, as women growing up with the school syllabuses and all of that.
Mm.
But I think that is changing. And, you know, obviously vanguards of that novelist. But the fact that, you know, Anna Hope is a contemporary novelist and doing that, that's a sign, I think.
Oh, Jessie, I could talk books to you all night. I did want to ask for your partner, what are the books that you have given him as gifts or recommendations?
Now I'm going to look like the worst girlfriend ever. What if I, well, one of the things was, like, because he was a bookseller, like, I didn't really buy him any books because, well, he had the discount. So I'm just trying to think, like, what books have I bought him? One book that I love to give people is What I Loved by Siri Husvett.
God, I love that book.
Oh, good. Good. I'm glad you do. It was given to me as a gift many moons ago, and I knew nothing about her or her background, and it was a sucker punch of a book. And I think it's one of the most beautiful books, and I'm really glad you like it.
I'd got this absolutely misguided idea from the cover and the title. It was going to be a sort of, like, you know, an 800 page lamentation on something which didn't interest me at all. I'm like, oh, 80s New York and drugs. Get him a face.
Like these strange sons who kind of, you know, one goes one route and obviously, and the other, and the, yeah, exactly. And the kind of art world, and this, what I loved about it is, wow. Was
what I loved about what I loved?
What I loved about what I loved was the construction of this artist, and like she really went to town, she did all the background, and like she is such a formidable person.
Yes.
Like so brainy. Like she has this background in psychology as well, and like you just know anything she sort of turns her hand to, she like ends up on the board of trustees for something. She's just an extraordinary person, and I've read a few of her books, but What I Loved is definitely my favourite. And it's, again, like what we were saying earlier, it's that the feeling, like the way you react to that, like you kind of clutched your heart. It's the same. It's a very moving book.
But because before I read it, I had this really like grubby, sordid, low-level obsession with Michael Ehrlich and that whole insane story about Party Monster and the sort of the drug murder stunt and Angel Mendez.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting because, I mean, obviously, I mean, her husband is Paul Auster as well, who's like somebody who's always like dealt with the whole like metafiction stuff and, you know, definitely from, I think, from a sort of tradition from Borges. And I think she seems to be quite interested in that as well.
Mm.
Like interplay between fiction and reality. And but I think she does it very differently to Paul Auster. And I, you know, kind of loath to even like bring him in as a, but he is a, I can only imagine being in a marriage like that. Like, God, I don't think I'd like it. Like I can be in a partnership with a bookseller, maybe not a book writer. Too much, but I can't imagine, you know, how much they've probably influenced each other as well as novelists.
I'd just like to see One Breakfast.
One Breakfast. I'd have breakfast with Paul Auster, but dinner with Siri Husvett.
Ah, that's a good. I like that. I was just thinking, I just want to watch them secretly at breakfast together, fighting over an espresso.
Yeah, probably like pulling the New York Times between each other to see who's had like better review.
They're probably eating cornflakes and wanting to be like Matilda.
Yeah, like Paul Auster's probably there, like staring at a pencil, like
I can levitate the spoon.
You never know.
Huge thanks to Jessie, and if you haven't read The Confession yet, go now. You need to meet Constance immediately. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I've been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me. Your Book is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. You can follow us on social media at YBooked, and if you enjoyed this episode, it would make my day if you left us a 5-star review, and it helps new listeners to find the podcast. I leave you with this from Anne Lamott. I know some very great writers you love, who write beautifully and have made a great deal of money.
and not one of them sits down routinely feeling wildly enthusiastic and confident. Not one of them writes elegant first drafts. See you next time.